WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The rally at Union Square last night calling for justice for Trayvon Martin, the teenager who was shot and killed after being followed by a neighborhood watch leader in Sanford, Florida. Could it happen here? WNYC criminal justice reporter Elsa Chang is looking at New York area civilian neighborhood patrols and joins me now along with John Jay College of Criminal Justice Professor Robert McCree, who's an expert in community policing. Hi, Elsa and Professor McCree. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi there.
Good morning.
Elsa, you say in your piece that New York has a love-hate relationship with its own neighborhood watch groups. Why love-hate?
Well, because New Yorkers have been conflicted about community patrol groups since 1979. You know, for instance, when the Guardian Angels first came onto the scene, there was a lot of ambivalence toward them. Then Mayor Ed Koch wouldn't even meet with their leaders for quite some months.
People called them vigilantes.
Exactly. And even today, you know, I was trolling the streets of Greenwich Village. I had spent the evening with a patrol volunteer there, David Poster, talking to residents. There was some ambivalence. You know, they said that they liked seeing visually a presence. They felt a little more secure sometimes. But there were some residents who told me that, you know, maybe they felt that they didn't need to be watched, and these were only four people at a time patrolling the streets of Greenwich Village. How much of a difference could they really make? There's some ambivalence as to how effective these groups are.
Professor McCree, are there good statistics on the impact of neighborhood watch groups on crime?
No, there aren't good statistics on it. There certainly is, however, a long tradition of providing volunteer services to the community, volunteer services that will make the people feel safer. And most of the public certainly want to feel safer.
Listeners, if you're in a neighborhood watch group, call us up and tell us about your group here. George Zimmerman in Sanford, Florida. Maybe giving them a bad name, should they all now be suspect? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Or if you have ever been watched by a neighborhood watch group, is that better or worse than the police? Neighborhood watchers don't do stop and frisk. Have you had contact with them in any other way than being a member? And was it good, bad, or mixed? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And in fairness, Elsa, we were talking off the air, and neither of us could think of an incident that was similar, really parallel to the Trayvon Martin shooting with respect to a neighborhood watch group in our area. There have been plenty of instances with respect to the actual police, Sean Bell, and then go back to, many others. But I can't think of a high-profile case that had to do with a neighborhood watch group here.
Well, absolutely. And there are some legal reasons for that. In terms of shootings by neighborhood watch volunteers, it's very difficult to have a case like Trayvon Martin happen here. I mean, to even have a carry permit in New York City when you're outside of law enforcement, when you're just a private citizen, is very, very rare. I mean, the example that's continually cited to me by police officers I've talked to is, well, maybe if you're a diamond dealer, you know, there have in history been carry permits granted to diamond dealers because the thought is a lot of them ferry their diamonds to and from work and they need that personal round-the-clock protection. And theoretically, you could think of an example that maybe a diamond dealer could volunteer for his local neighborhood watch group and carry a handgun with him. But those instances are so rare, and carry permits are so automatically or easily revoked by the NYPD if there's a case where a handgun's being used improperly, that no one could think of a case where a neighborhood watch volunteer actually walked around with a handgun, much less used one on a potential suspect.
Professor McCree, do you know of any?
No, I'd agree with what Elsa has said. And if that diamond dealer had decided it was time to go with his neighborhood watch group and carry his arm with him, he would likely have a lot of trouble with the police if they discovered that.
Right.
They would say, oh, you're being, have you been to the academy training? Do you understand what the law is? Do you understand what the requirements are that we have when we're armed? And he would lose his permit.
And that's just a hypothetical case.
That's
anyway.
Yes.
But you expressed concern in Elsa's piece about how neighborhood watch groups are vetted. So what do you mean by how they're vetted?
Well, consider we've got auxiliary police in New York that make are a long part of our history, and they are vetted by to make sure that they don't have a criminal record. They are questioned why they want to be on the auxiliary police, and then they go through a 54-hour training program before they can get their uniform and go on patrol. Now, a lesser activity are these auxiliary groups, and here it can be no training at all or extensive background check before they're part of the group.
When you say auxiliary groups, is there a difference between a private neighborhood group and the auxiliary police?
Enormous difference. The auxiliary police are recognized by law. They have 54 hours of training that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
They are supervised by someone in the precinct. They even have their own lawyer. They have their own union, even though they aren't paid.
And Elsa, why is there even such a thing as the auxiliary police? Civilians doing part of the job that you would think professional police officers are supposed to do, and these private neighborhood watch groups? Is it that the police are underfunded? Is it that the police don't do a good enough job?
I think there's a real acknowledgement in law enforcement that the more eyes and ears that we have out there, the better. And the better trained those eyes and ears are, the better. So given that recognition, they set up this program inviting citizens to sign up for actual training. But there's a very important difference I want to add to Mr. McCree's statements, and that is that not only are they unpaid, but they can't effectuate actual arrests. They're not real police. They don't even carry weapons. They certainly don't carry handguns. They can carry handcuffs and, I believe, nightsticks, I was told. They drive around in patrol cars that look like NYPD cars, but they have these huge letters that say auxiliary along the tail. But there are important differences to what they can do. Ultimately, they are citizens, so they can't actually make a real arrest.
Let's take a phone call as we talk about neighborhood watch groups in our area following on the Trayvon Martin case. And here is Farone in Montclair. Farone, thank you very much for calling. Hello.
Hi. You know, I was asked to join a neighborhood watch group, and it reminded me of something. Most people in neighborhoods that are the best watchers are the grandmothers that sit on the porch. And I think everybody else just gets in the way. I think they make themselves a target. I think they make confusion for the fact that, like you mentioned, maybe the police are certainly not underfunded. I think they have to be much more creative about how they do what they do. And I think that neighborhood people can watch without trying to be active or junior police.
Mm. Thank you very much. And yet, Professor McCree, there is a history in New York City that goes back to the Guardian Angels in the 70s and many other groups in many neighborhoods into the 80s, when there was so much more street crime in the city than there is now. Do you think that they have had an impact?
I do think they have had a positive impact on the decline in crime in the city, along with private security measures that we now take for granted, access control cameras, other measures. But these volunteer groups represent a kind of American spirit to protect your neighborhood, to look out for your neighbors, to make a difference. And we're not going to see them go away, though they're very different in the city of New York than in Florida or in most other parts of the country.
How so?
Well, the one that reflects George Zimmerman's group, where in Florida, neighborhood watch groups can be armed. And they can be armed without much training, without any training in self-defense other than what they have to have in order to be armed in the first place, without any understanding of exactly what their role is. It goes back to selection and training. They're weak in both of these areas in so many of these volunteer groups.
Danny in Massapequa, police officer. Hi, Danny.
Hi, good morning. It's a wonderful discussion. A couple of comments I'd like to make. First, on the incident down in Florida, I mean, I don't know what that watch guy thought he was doing. I mean, I think he sounds like he's mentally unstable. Someone would call the police 50 times in the last year and had been previously arrested for a violent offense. I don't know what this person was doing being part of any watch group. As far as these neighborhood patrols, and in New York City and out on Long Island, there are many levels of private security. You have gated communities that have people that stay at the gate. They police the grounds. In Times Square, you have the Times Square Redevelopment Group. You have the Midtown Redevelopment Group that hired security guards to stand on corners, and they did have a big impact on crime. The guess is completely wrong. They are allowed to make arrests like any other citizen can make arrests. They are discouraged not to because for liability purposes. If Joe Public is walking down the street and he sees somebody get robbed, it's called in fact committed. They are allowed to arrest him just like a police officer. The only police officers are only allowed to arrest people if following an investigation. Private citizens are not allowed to have investigations and knock on your door and say, we're going to arrest you. But if someone's breaking into your house, you can arrest them. You've seen the crime committed, and these people have, and they do make arrests, and that's why they carry handcuffs. They do not carry any weapons because for liability purposes, the last thing any private organization wants, whether it's a security guard guarding a North Shore Long Island condominium complex or a private security guard, is taking physical force because they're not trained for that and they tend to overreact. Mm-hmm. So if they're getting involved in a confrontation and it goes over their head, then the bad things can happen, and that's what happened in Florida. The guy was this was a closed community, and he was a watchman for the community. He was well within his jurisdiction to ask somebody what they were doing in an area where they weren't supposed to be. That's called the common law right of inquiry. I can walk up to somebody as a police officer and say, how you doing? Why are you standing in front of this store like wearing a coat when it's 95 degrees out? Mm-hmm. If you have a reasonable answer, it's over and you go about your day. When this kid didn't have an answer, the guy should have called the police, but he should have just followed him at a safe distance. This is where the guy went wrong, and this is where I believe this is just like, we love saying lone wolf terrorist and lone wolf thing. This is just a single person who should never have had a gun. It doesn't reflect any issues in society, and it does reflect the media's ability to take a cookie-cutter case, which is a white man or a Hispanic man shooting a minority kid. I can guarantee there's been 20 minority children killed in this country by other minority kids since this incident occurs, and nobody cares about these poor kids. It's only when it fits into the media's nice cookie-cutter scenario of an issue. And I'm sorry, but that's the way I feel.
Danny, thank you for your call. Elsa.
Danny, I would love to ask your opinion on that. The difference I was trying to draw was between a citizen's arrest and an actual police arrest. The way I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that when you're actually arrested by the police, it goes on a record, it goes in a central database. That is an official arrest. Prosecutors can decide if they really want to bring formal charges. It's in the system. When you make a citizen's arrest, that means you can tell a person to basically hold still until the police arrive. If the person looks like he wants to flee, you can actually use some force to restrain him or her to make sure that he doesn't go anywhere before the police arrive. But it's the police ultimately who makes that legal, official, actionable arrest that goes on someone's record that prosecutors can therefore act on. So it's my understanding that a citizen in whatever community patrol group or even a security guard cannot make those kind of arrests. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Now, Danny had had hung up because I thanked him for his call, and he thought we were done. But he heard you ask him a question, and he called back. So, Danny, did you get enough of Elsa's question to know what she was asking you?
Yes, I understand the question is that she's completely wrong. Macy's has private security guards that arrest you. Their name goes on the report. It's an official report.
Okay.
The person who detains you and deprives you of your right to leave has made the arrest. A lot of times, okay, when I was a police officer, I was down on a paper as being a reporting person, but the actual arrest would be a Macy's security guard who made the stop, because that's the person who has deprived you of
right.
your freedom.
Right. I guess we're just using the word arrest. Right. If you actually arrest somebody, you're detaining them. And so a citizen can do that.
As a uniformed police officer,
right,
my whole career, the last thing I needed was to show up at these scenes and even have the possibility that any of these guards were armed. They're nice people. They're working second job. They're trying to make money. Mm-hmm. And it all helps. More eyes help. But you call the police, then you back off. Now, if you call the police and the guy is starting to do a crime, you have every right to intervene. I mean, if the guy is breaking into an apartment where you know an 80-year-old woman lives there, you have every right as a citizen of this country to intervene. And so there's a line that can't be crossed, but I always err on the side of the person trying to do the right thing. On this case, he was trying to do the right thing, but he went way off the reservation. I don't know what he thought he was doing with the gun, and he's obviously going to go to jail because this poor kid did not deserve to be shot. At some point, I don't understand where he was, mm-hmm. where that man was confronted. You have to be confronted with deadly physical force. And if I'm a police officer or a man, I weigh 200 pounds, and I'm looking at a person who weighs 120 pounds, they are not going to confront. They're not having a deadly threat. I mean, you can't just shoot somebody because they're on your property or they're doing a crime. There has to be the added deadly physical threat.
Danny, thank you very much. And really, I appreciate all of that. And on the other issue that he raises, which is really for a different show, the outrage comes, I think, more than when young black guys kill other young black guys, is that those are explicitly acts of crime. And this, when law enforcement does it, or paralaw enforcement in this case, then those aren't supposed to be acts of crime. But if shots result from bias or whatever, then a different kind of outrage ensues. But that's really for another show. Let's get one more call in. Joe in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Brian.
Go ahead.
Couple of points. First of all, there is actually a program that pairs these groups together with the police. It's called a COP program, COP, Civilian Observation Patrol. So they're kind of integrated under the police department, and that is a local neighborhood group. So that's one thing. Second thing is that in the Jewish communities, as you'll recall, when with the Kletsky killing, there's actually a local groups, and the elder Jewish people, or even Jewish people that don't necessarily, the religious people that don't necessarily speak English that well, the groups kind of work as they help them with their language barrier. And also a lot of these people who have come over from Europe, they have this, you know, they have this thing in their mind that they're not so comfortable with law enforcement. So they would actually call these groups before they would call the police department. So there is a need for them, though they don't carry weapons and shooting them is a crazy thing. But there is a need for them because they do serve as a barrier.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I guess the two most well-known civilian watch groups in the city are probably the Curtis Sliwa Group, the Guardian Angels, which we mentioned before, and the one Joe refers to, or ones like the one Joe refers to, Shamrim for the Hasidic neighborhood.
Right.
In Borough Park.
And Williamsburg. They have a branch in Williamsburg.
But there are also often black and Latino-led ones in many different neighborhoods.
Right, and they take all different kinds of forms. I mean, the Shamrim is very well organized. They have dispatchers. They've registered some of their vehicles as ambulances so they can get sirens and run red lights. And then we see much more informal organizations, like police officers in the Bronx tell me. They see young men set up card tables in the lobbies of public housing projects just to watch who comes in and out the doors. Or our elderly residents in buildings who make sure that strangers announce their names and make them sign their names into guest books. These are all different permutations of the same idea, neighborhood patrolling.
So we're just about out of time. We're going to go next to Nicole Gelinas from the Manhattan Institute, who is going to be a supporter of the Paul Ryan budget when it comes to changes in Medicare and Medicaid and possibly even private workplace health insurance. We'll get to Nicole Gelinas, and she'll take your calls in just a minute. Pro-Ryan health reforms. But there's a – well, Trayvon Martin's parents were here in New York last night at the rally for justice for their son in Union Square that we played an excerpt from before. And there's a very viral petition online right now from change.org. At least according to them, they say a million people have signed Trayvon Martin's parents' petition to arrest George Zimmerman, the neighborhood watch shooter. Why were they here, Elsa, if this took place in Sanford, Florida?
Well, it's rallying. I mean, it's become a national, possibly even international story about basically relations. I mean, you know, there's this very, you know, Charles Blow wrote a wonderful piece in the New York Times last weekend about that conversation that parents have to have with little black boys. And there's this, you know, that it's just a different conversation that parents would have with little Asian girls or little white boys. That.
And we had a version of that on Morning Edition today with a family.
Yes, exactly. So they're trying to drum up support. Their charges still haven't been filed against George Zimmerman. These investigations are roiling along, and it's just to, you know, not only garner public attention but support that charges be filed and accountability.
John Jay College of Criminal Justice professor and community policing expert Robert McCree, WNYC criminal justice reporter Elsa Chang, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer and WNYC, Nicole Gelinas for the Ryan budget in a minute.